Being Bad, My Baby Brother, and the School to Prison Pipeline, the Teaching for Social Justice Series, 2014. The author is Crystal T. Laura. She is an African-American assistant professor of educational leadership at Chicago State University, located on Chicago's South Side. She explores leadership preparation for learning in the context of social justice with the goal of teaching school administrators to recognize, understand, and address the school-to-prison pipeline. During her second shift, she co-parents two marvelous boys who give her work in the field of education a sense of urgency. It's published by the Teachers College Press. The book is 115 pages, including the foreword, the epilogue, and the afterword. This book is a very candid narrative based on the true story of the author Crystal Laura's baby brother's experience and journey on the school-to-prison pipeline. In the foreword, she describes the level of angst that she experienced in opening up to the public about the struggles she and her family had with regard to her brother and her own need for understanding as an educator how this could have happened to them. Their mother was also an educator. At one point, she thought about changing some of the facts and names to avoid exposing her family to scrutiny and the judgment of people in the field, as well as just in general. The author has creatively woven research throughout the book that seems to flow fluently. This writing style was questioned by some of her professors while writing her dissertation as not being credible. However, she decided to move forward with her unique approach. The book could have easily become fiction, but the fact that it isn't is even more impactful. In the end, however, it was her brother Chris who wanted the story to be told truthfully or not at all. This book is a very intimate account of her story of navigating in real time and in hindsight the impact that these circumstances had on her family, her career, and herself. The thesis and overall theory of the book is that young Black boys are institutionally prepared by schools to transition to jail or prison. The lack of understanding of culture, labels, stereotypes, and conditioning with rule-based education is limiting and ineffective in reaching or educating Black boys. The achievement and opportunity gaps are startling based upon the data, and this is brought to life through a lived experience in this book. She was concerned about there being a misperception of her writings and that some may feel as though she's making excuses for his situation or blaming others or the system. She wanted to strike a proper balance between being candid without being overly exposed. As a result, she shared drafts with her family and especially with Chris, and no one expressed discomfort or regret. In reading this book, it flowed as if though you were sitting in Crystal Laura's living room with a warm cup of coffee and having interactions with a good friend and educator who's sharing her heart openly. I felt like I was along for the journey for the visits to the Cook County Jail where her brother was awaiting trial until their mother could raise $500,000 in bail. Consequently, this took 9 months, but she was able to raise the money for him to be released. The foreword was written by William Ayers, who vividly describes a promised visit to see Chris in the Cook County Jail. At this time, Crystal Laura is a student of Mr. Ayers, and she has shared her brother's situation with her professor. His description of the interaction with Chris provides great insight in what it feels like to be immersed in jail culture for a brief visit, how inhumane, humiliating, and beyond humbling this is, how unfathomable it would be to have to endure daily life in this setting and remain unchanged. Ayers states, in school, Chris eventually became a magnet for labels. The markers followed him around like flies, sometimes hemming him in and other times mocking him. The labels of the manila envelope followed him and eventually took hold. The opening chapter, entitled My Brother Chris, was a walk down memory lane in understanding how her brother, who is experiencing this time warp at age 21 in the confines of a jail and facing the possibility of spending a half a century behind bars. A young Black male facing 5 felonies who dropped out of school and has been diagnosed with clinical depression, a drug problem, and binge drinking. The school-to-prison pipeline is meant to describe students poorly educated, prepped for dead-end jobs, the streets, and permanent detention, screwed by the system with labels and low expectations. Chris is resolved to this bleak future and was eager to get started on his new life in prison, just to get on with it. This is a prison mentality of survival and new norms. There is an analogous use of language that describes a very similar set of circumstances in school settings later in later chapters. The state's attorney twisted facts and he was able to propose getting bail set at $1 million. The judge compromised at $500,000. Another strong component in the theory that the school-to-prison pipeline is set up for black males to fail. One of the most underpaid and marginalized segments of the population is overrepresented in the penal system, with the highest amounts of bail and the fewest resources. Chris goes to live with the author and her young family. He is very into rap music and social media. He's focused on getting his music noticed and utilizing his talent for writing lyrics, a common theme for African-American males, music, athletics, poetry, and language arts as identified cultural strengths for many in storytelling and narratives set to music. The next chapter outlines the school-to-prison pipeline as an overall theory, and then how Chris became part of this narrative by explaining his formative years in K-12. There are three metaphors that she outlines. The school to jailhouse track, where Chris goes through a series of interactions with teachers that led to him getting labeled with ADHD. He was offered medication, as well as a long trial of behavioral referrals and problems being noted in his file. He switched schools several times due to zero tolerance guidelines and the label of being a quote-unquote bad kid. The silent epidemic reported by the Civic Enterprises, a public policy firm, in 2006, shows that nearly half of all youth of color do not graduate with their high school class. The problem is particularly acute for African Americans, who represent 15% of the population below the age of 18, but make up 14% of all dropouts, 26% of all youth arrested, and 46% of those detained in juvenile jails. 58% of those juveniles are sent to adult prisons. This is not an ideological claim, rather statistics speak for themselves. Other bodies of scholarship conveyed the fact that black boys lag behind their peers academically on every indicator and are underrepresented in advanced placement classes or otherwise enriched gifted programs. Why is this? I'm suggesting it's the opportunity gap. Rarely are gifts and strengths readily identified and associated with black males. Their strengths are often labeled negatively and described as not being focused or undisciplined when expressing and demonstrating these cultural strengths. It's simply not valued by mainstream education. In Cook County, where they lived, black boys accounted for 11% of the students, but made up 35% of those suspended and 44% of those expelled. Several other global stats were shared, but the overall thesis is that black male students are disciplined more often and more harshly in a disproportionate fashion. The fact that black students are over-disciplined does not go unnoticed by the youth themselves. They are sharp and intuitive, and as a result develop maladaptive coping skills in an attempt to avoid landmines and apologetically fit into a biased subculture of schools. White students and teachers see this phenomenon as unintentional and unconscious, while students of color see it as deliberate and conscious. They argue that teachers are applying rules arbitrarily to exercise control and to remove the students that they don't like. The second metaphor is the cradle to prison pipeline. The Children's Defense Fund attempted to identify early indicators such as low birth weights, born to a teenager, poor and poorly educated single moms with an absent father, and the lack of health care or lack of early childhood education. The author describes the cradle to prison pipeline as too offsetting for her because it focuses on deficits instead of strengths. The third is the school to prison nexus. A friend of hers and a colleague who wrote the afterword also wrote a book entitled The Right to Be Hostile, and it rocked the world as it her world as it unpacks the business of the prison industrial complex. She says that schools are a party to this. She also points out that schools sometimes look and feel an awful lot like prison. She also describes the stagnation of funding in education alongside the ballooning resources available for prison and policing. The sheer need to acknowledge that schools produce gifted students and successful learners needs to be balanced with the inverse of remedial learners and educational failures. Chapter 3 was the tipping point, and this is where Crystal Laura further outlines the literature and supports the research and theoretical framework for the pipeline, as well as the subtleties that are associated with this that often go unnoticed. Chris himself identified that something was wrong. They took him to a psychiatrist where he was diagnosed with bipolar 2 disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, and ADHD combined type. He was prescribed Seroquel XR, and it was being titrated to stabilize his mood. Crystal Laura explained how she didn't know what would be worse, a racing manic mind or mind-numbing depression with a drug-induced stupor, which is what he was dealing with. The fact that he acknowledged that he has a problem was significant to Dr. Laura. She also described settings and teacher styles that ultimately did Chris in. A nun, a parochial school that was highly structured, and then a teacher that she describes like Sybil with multiple personalities. Some days relational, other days highly structured with very little interactivity or creativity and repetitive lectures. The fourth chapter was 21 questions, in which it was a self-reflective chapter for both Chris and Dr. Crystal. She recalls wishing that someone had just taken the time to reach out of concern that he was skipping classes or acting out behaviorally to try to find ways to help instead of perpetuating the problem. The final chapter is walking the path. And she compares following someone on this journey of school to prison as chasing a violent storm. In speaking to educators, parents, and the like, she would entitle her comments to them as quote unquote, getting intimate, a vision of love, justice, and joy in education. The short version is that we must educate in love. An act of love is a deliberate attendance to people, seeing and taking notice of what they believe is meaningful. Listening versus hearing. The act of listening is central to the process of getting intimate and actually hearing what someone is saying. You cannot teach those you do not love, and you cannot teach a child that you don't respect or understand. Justice, she says, is the next thing where we should become teacher activists. And that part of being an activist, as opposed to producing patriotic citizens and law-abiding citizens, we should be speaking towards equity and transforming through volunteering, rallying, and lobbying. The last part is joy, and she references Leif Gustafson's Youth Learning on Their Own Terms, and it's a reminder that we need to be responsive to students' identity and cultural background. She also suggests, Gustafson suggests that we should be teacher ethnographers. And an ethnographer approaches as if they know nothing and positions themselves as learners and observers, interviews and participates to better understand the people they're working with. Overall, I related to this book on so many levels, having raised 3 black boys to young men. The way that this is written provided a nice balance between a compelling true story and the research and data to support her position. I found this to be a nice balance to my preference and learning style. No surprise in hindsight that I was able to relate well to a book written by an author who is a woman, African American, and struggling with the challenges of raising and educating black boys. If only more academic literature and research had been written this way with this approach, I may have found a passion for learning earlier on. Students of color are being culturally conditioned to believe that white is superior and color is inferior. Students of color are being marginalized through discipline, lack of access, or under-identified for opportunities for success, such as AP or gifted classes. They're over-identified for special needs services and medication without the proper supports being put in place and unfairly labeled and disciplined compared to their white peers. This is also very obvious in society with people being profiled, where some are given a warning for behavior and feel free to speak back to authority, while other people of color may be reprimanded just for a look or a gesture. The data and research speak for themselves, and it is beyond time that we have a more widely accepted approach in educating the culturally diverse population that we have. Educators are ill-prepared and lack the knowledge necessary for transformative change to occur in our educational system. The driving force should be the disproportionate amount of students that we are failing to educate. It's a huge black eye on the effectiveness of our educational system in the United States. Crystal Laura proposes a critical race theory that should be adopted and further researched in meeting the needs of all students.